Coming up now on Focus, an hour devoted to writing and reading. First, we'll hear from NPR's Guy Raz. He's the man behind the 3-Minute Fiction contests held on Weekend All Things Considered. The program has sponsored several of these contests, inviting listeners to send in their work of fiction that takes only 3 minutes to read, with a few special stipulations thrown in. The result has been phenomenal in both the quantity and quality of the entries, and Guy will tell us how the contest works in a few minutes. Then Kelly Strom of the Champaign Public Library joins us to suggest some spring and summer reading longer than 3 minutes, ranging from new novels by Elizabeth Berg and Sophie Kinsella to the latest thrillers from Stephen King and Dan Brown. Plus, we'd love to hear what you're reading. I'm Jim Meadows, inviting you to join the conversation on Focus. It's coming up after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Later this hour, we'll be talking to Kelly Strom of the Champaign Public Library. We'll be talking about some good reading for this spring and summer. But first on Focus, we'll hear an interview I recorded last month with NPR's Guy Raz. Because the interview is recorded, we won't be able to take your calls. Guy Raz has been with NPR for several years. He's been a reporter in various locations. He's been the host of Weekend All Things Considered. He's now working on a new NPR show, the TED Radio Hour, but we're going to talk about just one of Guy's brainchildren, and that's the 3-Minute Fiction Contest, and that is a fixture of Weekend, All Things Considered. Welcome to the program, Guy. Glad to have you.
It's great to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Tell me, were you anchoring, hosting Weekend, All Things Considered at the time you thought up the 3-Minute Fiction Contest?
Yes. In fact, I thought of the contest before I began anchoring the program. I was on a sabbatical year doing a journalism fellowship, and I was trying to think of ways where we could create some kind of device on the program that would really connect us with listeners. You know, we ask our listeners to contribute to public radio, but we don't always ask them to contribute content, to actually be a part of the show, to be on the air with us. And so I thought of this idea where we would ask listeners to write original fiction and to send it in. And you know, writing a piece of fiction isn't easy. So I was thinking of a way we could do it that would be manageable. And 3 minutes sounded about right. You know, 3 minutes is a good amount of time on the radio. I timed it out. It was about 600 words. So that was it. That's how it began. When I became the host of All Things Considered on the Weekend in 2009, I said, let's do this. I want to do this thing, and let's call it 3-Minute Fiction. And I had a friend who happens to be James Wood, who is the literary critic of The New Yorker, and he agreed to be our first judge, and that was it. And it took off, and we expected to get maybe a few hundred entries. We received 5,000 original short stories.
That's in the first edition of the contest?
In the first round. Now, 4 years on, we've received close to 70,000 original pieces of fiction by listeners all over the country.
I was wondering, Guy, was fiction writing something you had been particularly interested in before, whether it was writing it or reading it?
You know, no, not really. I mean, I've always been sort of steeped in the nonfiction world, whether it's been as a reporter or even as a student. I studied history, and I didn't do a whole lot of fiction. I always enjoyed reading it. And I took a class during my sabbatical year when I was doing a fellowship, and it was called Post-War American and British Fiction, and it really struck. I mean, it had a really deep impact on me. I got to read books by authors who I had read before, but less well known books. You know, Pnin by Nabokov and Loving by Henry Green and. We read books by Saul Bellow and Ian McEwan, and we read Revolutionary Road before the film came out. You know, really great and interesting books. And that really got me thinking about the power of fiction and about the power of fiction to transport you somewhere, to take you to a place. And I thought, can we do that in a short period of time? Could you transport somebody somewhere in just 3 minutes? And the answer has resoundingly been yes over the past 4 years. I mean, people have taken us to places and to moments in their in the lives of their characters that are extraordinary, and they do it in just 600 words. And I think one of the reasons why so many people have participated in this contest is because it is manageable. It's something that, you know, people can really do.
I was wondering just the technicals of the contest. Does it have to be exactly 3 minutes or no more than 3 minutes? How do you decide the time limit here?
Well, it's a little tricky because everybody reads at a different pace, right? So we say, I always said at the beginning that it's got to be a story that can be read in about 3 minutes or less. So sometimes, you know, depending on who's reading the story, I usually ask my colleague Susan Stamberg to read the winning story. You know, she has a beautiful, beautiful voice, and so Susan might take 3.5 minutes or 3 minutes, 15 seconds, but each story has to be under 600 words. That's the limit. So it can't be 601. It's got to be 600 words or less, and you can't go over that number. And so that is roughly 3 minutes for most readers.
And that is very short. I'm trying to think of, you know, well-known classic short stories. The Telltale Heart is pretty short, but that's more than 600 words, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. You know, we've had, I mean, just this past round, so the last round, round 10, was judged by Mona Simpson, the novelist Mona Simpson, who wrote the book My Hollywood. And we received, I think, about 5,000 stories this round. And we have, what we do is we have student writers from all over the country, from the University of Oregon and UT Austin, even the University of Illinois. We've got students from NYU and the Iowa Writers Workshop, Berkeley, all over. And they read through the first wave of stories, and they've got criteria. We tell them what to look for.
Yeah, that's something I'm wondering about. What do you look for? What criteria for saying no?
Well, it's really an art and not a science, you know. And as you know, I mean, all literary criticism is subjective, right? Because what, you know, I talk about Hemingway, or I can talk about, Proust, and some people may love those writers and some people may hate them. There is an element of individual, what an individual likes. But each round there's a challenge. So in this challenge, Mona Simpson, she said that each story has to be written in the form of a voicemail message. So the first thing you want to do is you want to make sure that that is how the story is written. And the second thing is it's got to be under 600 words or less. So, you know, about 10% of the entries usually more or less are longer than 600 words or don't abide by the rules. So you've got people who are submitting stories that they may have written for other contests that they're kind of repurposing. So those are automatically filtered out. And then I think the readers are looking for how people have used that space of 600 words, how they've used words, how they've used scenes. Is there a narrative? If there isn't a narrative, is it evocative? Does it move you emotionally? Does it make you laugh? Does it affect you in some way? They're looking at how you are, you know, you're able to really create something powerful in that short space of time.
The 3 minute time limit must really force a writer to make choices on what to leave in and what to throw out. Do you see that affecting the types of stories that come in?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is no. I don't see it affecting the types of stories that come in because, as you can imagine, having received, you know, more than 70,000 stories, you get all kinds. I mean, in this past round alone, the winning story was called Sorry for Your Loss, a beautiful story by Lisa Rubinson from Charlotte, North Carolina, which you can find. You can find all of these stories at npr.org/3-minute-fiction. And her story was, it was a voicemail message from a young woman, or from a woman named Christine, to her ex-boyfriend named Nick. And she leaves a voicemail message, and then she keeps re-recording it. She keeps erasing it and then re-recording a different message. And she's calling him because his mother has died. And she's trying to say the right thing in the form of a voicemail message. And she just can't figure out the right words to use. And she keeps deleting her message and then re-recording her message. And it is a heartbreaking and beautiful and incredibly surprising story. There's a twist at the end that you don't expect and you don't anticipate. And when we saw this story, I mean, Mona, our judge, picked this as the winner. You know, when we saw this story, it was just this beautiful, it said so much in such a short period of time. You found out so much about Nick and about Christine and about Nick's mom and about who Christine is and who she loves and what her life is like. It was a really incredible piece. And then we had other pieces this round. We had a story called Everything's Under Control by Eric Bronner of Eugene, Oregon. He wrote a story about a man who works at the zoo who releases an elephant for, you know, reasons that are not entirely clear. Then he loses the elephant, and then he's trying to figure out how to recapture the elephant through this phone call that he's making from jail.
That was amazingly funny for just 600 words, and really, really just in the opposite direction from the winning entry.
Yeah, entirely different story, you know. And then there's another one that's also quite funny, After the Tone, by a woman named Jackie Higgins Daly from Phoenix. And this is a woman who's leaving a message for her boyfriend about their, you know, about their complete incompatibility. And, you know, she is describing watching a dog walker and just how this dog walker is straining to keep the dog from going faster, and the man's pulling the dog back and with all his strength. And this woman on the voicemail messages is comparing that to the relationship with her boyfriend. Very, very good story. Very, very well done.
Well, I'm wondering about the people who submit entries. Do you have any professional writers competing? Are they allowed to?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, they're all anybody. This is open to anybody over the age of 18. So if you are a U.S. resident over 18, you can submit your story. And we get all kinds of people writing. And I can tell you that about half of the winners over the previous 10 rounds have been complete amateurs, people who have never published anything in their lives, who have no formal or even informal training. And then about half of them have been people who've maybe taken a creative writing course in college or who studied creative writing or who may have published one or two things in very obscure journals, but nobody famous, you know, nobody who's made a career or a living off writing. None of the winners.
So Philip Roth and Stephen King have not yet sent anything
yet.
That have won.
No, we're still waiting for Philip Roth's piece. no, not yet. But, you know, it really is a testament, I think, to the undiscovered talent all over the country. It really is.
I'm wondering, Guy, have you ever, you know, even if you didn't actually enter, have you ever attempted a 3-minute piece of fiction?
You know, I've tried almost every round, and this time it was a little bit too close to home, the prompt that Mona Simpson gave to write a voicemail message, because I wrote a story based on a series of voicemail messages that I had once left for my wife. I was traveling as a foreign correspondent in the Middle East. I couldn't reach her, and then started to create these, like, paranoid fantasies in my mind about something horrible happening to her, and I started sort of freaking out. Only to discover later that her phone actually had died. And so I had left her a series of frantic voicemail messages saying, you know, where are you? And finally she reached me, you know, the next day and just said, you're crazy. That was a true story.
Did you finish that entry?
I did, yes. But as I say, a little bit too close to home, a little bit too personal.
I'm wondering, has the contest always stipulated that that the story follows certain rules? Did you do that in the very first one?
Well, what happened in the first round was, and this is really, you know, when I came up with the idea for 3 Minute Fiction, I didn't really know what to expect. We didn't partner with any student writers, you know, graduate students. We didn't have any relationships with other organizations. So we asked, so James Wood came on, and we said, okay, it's 3 Minute Fiction, and write anything you want. And so there was no challenge, and there were no parameters. And we got all kinds of stories from all over the place. And they were great, but it made it a little bit harder to evaluate them because we didn't have any criteria. The other problem we had was that we received 5,000 stories, and the staff of Weekend All Things Considered is just eight people who have to put together, you know, 2 1-hour news programs a week. It's a lot of work because it's a highly produced show with original content. We would travel. It took us 2 months to read all of those stories, and we read them. I mean, I sat with stacks and stacks of papers in my house reading them into the wee hours of the morning. But we did it, and after that round, we kind of regrouped and said, well, maybe we should narrow this. So in the second round, James Wood was our judge again. He said every story has to begin, the nurse left work at 5 o'clock. And that made it, and that really narrowed it down. And we basically had all kinds of stories from that round. You know, we had people saying, you know, writing stories about nurses, or writing stories about female nurses, male nurses, writing stories that had nothing to do with nurses, that the nurse left work at 5 o'clock, passed a bus station, and then you're on the bus with a completely different character. Or one person wrote, the nurse left work at 5 o'clock was the worst punk album of the 80s. You know, so people really came up with creative ways of taking that challenge and running with it. And we've done that ever since. Every round is at a challenge, whether it's go to the website, look at a photograph. The last round with Brad Meltzer, round 9, the great thriller writer, and the host of Decoded, he asked our readers, our listeners, to write a story that revolved around a fictional, a U.S. president, real or fictional. There was a round where every character had to come to town and one character had to leave town. So, you know, we've had these very interesting challenges that have really been developed by our judges. And it's been remarkable to watch how, you know, listeners, public radio listeners, have just responded to those challenges and come up with incredible narratives based on those challenges.
Have all the different genres been represented in the entries?
You know, I would say yes. It's impossible for me to say definitively, but we've had humor, we've had thrillers, we've had mysteries, we've had romance, we've even had sort of historical fiction stories, we've had drama, we've had family drama, we've had crises, we've had adventure, space travel, time travel. God, I can go on and on. I mean, we've had deaths and births. We've lived thousands of lives since we launched 3 Minute Fiction through these different stories.
Are you ever surprised by how much, I was asking a little earlier about the choices that writers have to make, but ever surprised by how much people can get into 600 words?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all you have to do is look at, to answer that question, is to look at the winner of round 8, which and I hate to say this because I love all of the stories, but the winner of that story is, that was my favorite 3 Minute Fiction story out of the 70,000. And the challenge that round was that every story had to begin. She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. Okay, that's every story had to begin that way. And the winner of that story was a woman named Carrie McKillop from Charlotte, Vermont. It's pronounced Charlotte, not Charlotte, just as a point of points. and the story was called Rainy Wedding. And Jim, I got to tell you, this was one of the most beautiful pieces of fiction I've ever read in my life. And listeners now can go to 3minutefiction, npr.org/3minutefiction, and find this story under the round 8 stories called Rainy Wedding. And Carrie wrote a piece that I'm not going to reveal all the details of it, but it's about, it's imagining a wedding. It's about a little boy imagining his wedding. And I got to tell you, when I heard that story, what we do is I've read the stories before we bring the winner on. Obviously, I'm part of the judging process. We brought Carrie MacKillop on with our judge that round, Luis Alberto Urrea, the novelist. And he came on, and we had Susan Stamberg, our legendary correspondent here, read the story. And I couldn't open my mouth. I couldn't speak after she read that story. It was so powerful. It moved me so powerfully in just 3 minutes, in just 600 words, that it took me about a minute to compose myself. And that, to me, is the power of three-minute fiction. That's what's happened, is that you've got people like Carrie MacKillop, who runs a small little food store in Charlotte, Vermont, who is writing fiction like some of the best contemporary fiction writers in this country. And she's just sitting there in Charlotte, Vermont. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Have any of the entrants, have you seen their names other places? Have any of them been published in other places, perhaps after entering the three-minute fiction contest?
Well, the first thing we did was last two rounds ago, I partnered up with the Paris Review, the literary journal, and they were interested in partnering up with us and publishing the winning story. So now, for the last two rounds and for the next round, the winning story gets published in the Paris Review, which is a huge deal. I mean, if you are an unpublished writer and you get published in the Paris Review, there are few laurels as prestigious as that one. I mean, we're talking about one of the preeminent literary journals in the country and in the world in the English language. So that's the first thing. The second thing is many of the winners from the previous rounds have gone on to sign agreements with literary agents. Most of them are contacted right after. I mean, it's huge exposure because you've got 1.5 million people listening to All Things Considered on the weekend. And, you know, you've got people on the web, on the internet. There's a community on Facebook. And so a lot of the winners have gone on to sign agreements. One of them is in the middle of writing a novel. One of them is working on a collection of short stories. I know that a few of them have published work elsewhere, but I believe that most of them are pursuing professional careers in writing, which is amazing because not a single one of our winners has been professional in the sense that they derive all of their income from writing.
Okay. So aspiring but not full-time writers.
Exactly. That's right.
Well, you certainly mentioned the heavy response you get in entries to the three-minute fiction contest. What sort of listener response have you gotten overall?
I'll tell you what we get. Every time we launch a new round of three-minute fiction, it lasts about 6 weeks because it takes a long time to read through those stories. You know, we really carefully read through every story we receive. And then we take a break, you know, usually a month or so. And during that month-long period, I got to tell you, I am inundated with emails from listeners saying, when is the next round of three-minute fiction starting? When is the next round starting? They want it to be on every single weekend. And I know from traveling around the country when I visit public radio stations or when I go to other events, people always come up to me to talk about three-minute fiction. You know, they love three-minute fiction. They love what it's become. They feel connected to NPR through three-minute fiction. And So we know anecdotally and also based on the emails we've received from listeners how, you know, how amazing it's been. I'll tell you one quick little story. We received a story that was a finalist in round one of 3 Minute of Fiction. That finalist was so excited. She called me at NPR and left a voicemail message for me, and she was so excited. I called her back. She mentioned that she was coming to Washington in a few days, if she could come visit. I said, sure. You know, I thought she was maybe a little nutty. She's become a very close friend. We just went and visited her. Me and my wife and kid just went to visit her and her husband this past weekend. We've become very good friends with them, and we met them through 3 Minute Fiction.
Amazing. Has the contest inspired other writing competitions, maybe at local public radio stations or anywhere?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, 3 Minute Fiction is something that you know, I created here at NPR, and we love the response. It's been incredible. We love the community that it's created, and we just really are so excited to have that community, to have so many people around the country who see 3 Minute Fiction as a kind of a gathering point, a gathering place. And as I say, we never expected it. You know, I thought 3 Minute Fiction was going to last during the summer of 2009, and here we are in 2013 talking about you know, when the next round is going to begin.
Well, I'm wondering if the popularity of the 3 Minute Fiction contest says anything about the state of fiction today. I don't see much of a general market for short fiction in this country anyway, and the contest entries are really short. People have less time and maybe shorter attention span. So why aren't there more popular level short stories catering to them?
Well, I tell you something, Jim, microfiction has taken off in recent years, you know, and I don't think it's about short attention spans. At least that's the way I see it. I mean, a lot of people have asked, you know, is the Twitter generation interested in this, or the Facebook, or the, and I don't think that's what it's about. I really think it's about the challenge of packing in really evocative, clear, crisp language in a short space. It's not easy to do, and it really requires a lot of thought. You know, you can't just, you know, bang something out very quickly. And so I think that there is actually a market. I mean, you've got some excellent young and older short story writers. We've had them as our judge, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Danielle Evans. They write short fiction. You know, The New Yorker publishes short fiction every week. You've got Don DeLillo, you know, he writes short fiction. He released a book about 2 years ago, just a collection of shorter pieces. So there is an interest in it, certainly. And I don't know whether I'm not an economist or an analyst, so I couldn't tell you whether there's a lucrative market in short fiction. But I think there's an interest and a passion in it, and I can tell you that my data point is 70,000 stories that we've received here at NPR for 3 Minute Fiction.
Well, you're now, as I said earlier, working on a new NPR show, the TED Radio Hour. Are you still staying involved with the 3 Minute Fiction contest?
Absolutely, yes. So I left as the host of Weekend All Things Considered, which was a wonderful experience, 4-year experience. But I had an opportunity to launch this new program on NPR, the TED Radio Hour, which we launched in early March, March 1st, actually. And it's been an incredible journey, and I am doing that. That's now my job. We are broadcast all over the country, and I am still very involved in 3 Minute Fiction. I am the curator of 3 Minute Fiction, so whenever we launch a new round, I'm involved in every aspect of it, and picking the judges, and reading stories, and working on the challenge with the judge, and working on the production schedule and calendar. So it's, you know, it's my baby, and I love doing it, and I love being involved with it. So I keep my hat in that ring as well.
Round 11, I guess, would be the next one. Has that been scheduled, and have the rules been set yet?
Not yet. And I can't reveal any details. I am sworn to secrecy, punishable by death, I've been told by my producer. But we are working on it. We're working on a time frame. We're hoping it will happen next month, that we'll launch it next month. We're working on a new judge and a new challenge, and hopefully thousands more new stories.
In the meantime, you can read the stories from the previous 3-Minute Fiction contests at npr.org/3MinuteFiction, all written out. And Guy, is there a particular story that sticks in your head, whether it was a round winner or not, that you might direct people to?
I love the story Rainy Wedding from Round 8. I just think it really blew my mind. I love one of the stories I also love is the winner of this round, Sorry for Your Loss, I thought was a terrific story. I would just go and peruse. We've got probably 200 to 300 stories on the page. I would just go and peruse those stories. You will not be disappointed.
Well, Guy Raz, I wanted to thank you very much for talking with us today. Guy Raz with NPR, the TED Radio Hour, and the weekend All Things Considered 3-Minute Fiction Contest.
Oh, thank you, Jim.
Quite welcome.
It's time for a short break now, and when we return, we'll talk about some good books for the warm weather with Kelly Strom of the Champaign Public Library. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus, and now let's turn from writing very short fiction to reading something longer, some novels to help us while away the spring and summer hours. And Kelly Strom manages the adult fiction collection at the Champaign Public Library. She has a few suggestions for us, and we'd like your suggestions, too. Read any good books lately? Well, call and tell us about them at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580, and the phone numbers again, 333-WILL, toll-free at 800-222-WILL. Kelly Strom, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
And read any good books lately?
I sure have. Okay. I can't help but read good books lately.
You know, I'm wondering, there's something about, and this is a real old question, is there something about warmer weather that affects people's reading habits or interests?
Well, I think traditionally people kind of lighten up in the summer. You know, you hear about the stories about beach reads. You know, this is a great beach read. I think with the warmer weather and the sunshine, I think people may be just like lighter fare. And that's usually what we'll see in this time of year. And the publishers agree. I think they come out with a lot of quick bestsellers in the summertime.
Well, one title on the list that you presented to us for today's show is one that certainly got our producer Lindsay Moon's attention, because she is a big fan of Dan Brown, best known for The Da Vinci Code. And he apparently has a new novel out. Is this in the collection yet at the Champaign Public Library?
We are awaiting for it to come on the shelves. I think the original or the release date is sometime in April. I can't think of the exact date, but it is on our catalog, so you can put your name on hold for it right now.
And this is, I guess, the fourth novel in Dan Brown's series about Harvard professor of symbology, Robert Langdon. I don't know how many professorial chairs there are in that subject, but he's certainly had a lot to do in this series.
Certainly. This one really sounds interesting as well as the other ones. This one, they're saying, they're keeping it kind of hush-hush, but one of the publishers has come out saying that the book is actually about Dante and his Divine Comedy, and that's where the title Inferno came from. And Robert Langdon is going to do his conspiratorial business around Dante's Inferno.
And I'm looking at some of the blurb at Amazon.com, and there's copy here about an ingenious riddle that pulls him into a landscape of classic art, secret passageways, and futuristic science, drawing from Dante's dark epic poem, which makes me wonder, you know, a lot of people who read Dan Brown may not have read Dante's Inferno. I have not. I tried once. I did not get very far. Do you see examples? Do you hear anecdotes of people making a transition from when they read something light that references something weighty of really getting into that weightier piece of literature?
Absolutely. People read something, even just a regular story that might mention a classic or mention some point in history, and people do enjoy going back and maybe looking even in an encyclopedia about that geographical region or a historical book about something that went on in history. Or, like you said, they'll pick up a classic and see where the ideas from the current book drew from. So, yeah, we do find I do that quite a bit myself, but
okay,
want to learn something.
Well, I'm wondering, looking at this list, are there any writers here that you're fond of yourself?
Well, of course, Stephen King is a classic, and he's got a new one coming out called Joyland, and this one is a little different from some of his classic things that some people may be familiar with. This one is the story of a college student. He comes to a small town, North Carolina amusement park. It takes place in 1973. And he finds the legacy of a vicious murder, the fate of a dying child, and the ways both will change his life forever. It's interesting. It's kind of a whodunit. It's kind of a Carney novel as well. And with a little bit of supernatural thrown in there. But I love Stephen King. People, I think, try to put him in a box of scary horror man. But he is the master at character development and looking at the issues of good versus evil, which I love.
This book, according to Amazon, is scheduled to come out in about 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how does it work in the library business about when you get books, and especially now that you have the added wrinkle of e-books in circulation from the library?
A couple things. Bestsellers like this, Dan Brown, Stephen King, John Grisham, any of these big bestsellers, we do get them in our departments in advance so that we can put them on our catalog. So we, you know, attach the stickers and we enter them correctly into our computer catalog. And then we have to hold them until the publisher's release date. So we can't release them any earlier than the bookstore does.
You cannot be bribed, I tell
you. And, you know, there, back when Harry Potter, the seventh one, came out, boy, was that under wraps. I mean, you weren't even allowed to, like, open the covers and read inside, even as a staff member. So, yeah, they keep these closely guarded, that's for sure. And as far as ebooks, it's the same situation. They can't be released until the actual publisher's release date.
Well, you've given us a list which is roughly in the category of men's fiction and women's fiction. Is it always that easy to define what's for men and what's for women?
Oh, not always. If you go stereotypical, you'll get women's fiction usually deals more with interrelationships, how it's usually women characters and how they relate to their family members, their friends. And it's really more delving into character development with maybe a little bit of historical in there, just current day. Now, men's fiction, I call it, you get the adrenaline rush. You know, these are the testosterone pumping books about chases or crashes or political intrigue or things like that that people, the men, would be traditionally more interested in.
Well, let's look at one of the women's fiction selections. I was looking at Marissa Silver, who has a novel called Mary Coyne, and that is Coyne like pennies and nickels, but I was wondering what that was about.
This one sounds so interesting to me, and I haven't read it yet. But you might remember back, there's a famous black and white photograph from the Depression era of a woman looking mournfully kind of at the camera, and she's worried, and her starving children are in the background. I'm not sure. I think when people saw the picture, they would easily recognize that. But the author took that picture and then kind of made up a story around it.
This is, and I'm looking at the Amazon blurb on this, Dorothea Lange's migrant mother photograph. It is really an iconic photograph. They've colorized it for the book cover,
yes,
which is a little different. But it is an older, still attractive woman, but someone who has really seen a lot of hard living, looking out very pensively at...
Yeah. Obviously distraught.
Who knows what during the days of the Dust Bowl.
Exactly.
And And the question is, what is this woman's story?
Mm-hmm.
As the blurb put it, the photograph itself comes from 1936. A young mother resting by the side of a road in central California, spontaneously photographed by Dorothea Lange, who was documenting the migrant laborers of the time. But we find something out about a story of which could be of this woman, I guess, in this novel by Marisa Silver.
Yeah, the authors changed the names, but which is where the name Mary Coyne came from. And basically, she just kind of makes up what was this relationship about and what was this woman's story. But you'll see from the cover of the book, it's all based on just that one photograph.
So there is a fictional version, a different name of a photographer who could be Dorothea Lange. And mm-hmm. a third character is a present day professor of cultural history who discovers, as the blurb puts it, a family mystery embedded in the picture. And I'm sure there's a lot of pages you can get out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds interesting. Once again, it's about an interrelationship between the different characters. It's beautifully written. The author is a very literary author who her prose is quite fluid and descriptive, and it should be a good one.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. There's still time for your suggestions if you want to call in with about good spring and summer reading as we talk with Kelly Strom at the Champaign Public Library. You can call us at 333-9455. That's our toll-free at 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we did have a couple of things that came through our Facebook page. Maeve wrote us saying that she loved The Warmth of Other Suns. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lack was one which was brought up by a couple of people. Excuse me. Henrietta Lacks is the correct pronunciation there. Maeve calls it my go-to recommendation. In terms of fiction. And I don't know if that's a title that sticks out with you.
Both of those were huge. Both of those books were very popular. They both appeared on the bestseller list. A lot of people loved them quite a bit.
Okay. And I'm just making a quick look at The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which is by Rebecca Skloot, if you're looking at it. And I take it that it is in the collection at the Champaign Public Library.
Absolutely.
Any of the women's writers that you're familiar with personally that you've taken a liking to?
Well, one of them that I brought in here today is a book by Sophie Kinsella. Now, a lot of people enjoy reading her. She's a very light writer, so the books are the perfect beach reads. And a lot of people may recognize her as being the author of Confessions of a Shopaholic, which was huge. Well, she's got a new one now out called Wedding Night that I think looks really interesting. It's about a woman named Lottie. She's tired of having boyfriends that just don't want to commit. And when her latest breakup occurs, she meets up with an old friend of hers, I think from high school or college, I forget, and they have a run-in. And he reminds her of a deal that they made at one point, saying if neither one of them were married by 29, they'd marry each other. So spur of the moment, that she says, yeah, you're right. Let's just go ahead and do that. So she decides to marry him and go to a Greek isle for their honeymoon. And her family members and friends are not happy about this situation.
I'm already seeing the casting choices being made for the romantic comedy that will be filmed, that could be filmed out of this book. This is Wedding Night, a novel. Latest one from Sophie Kinsella. Is that available yet, or are we still waiting?
Well, all of the ones that I brought here today are ones that are spring and summer releases. So most of these are not yet available. They're on our catalog, so you can put your name on the hold list. But they're all coming out April, May, and June.
Okay. I'm wondering if I asked you, you know, what are people reading right now? What are they checking out right now? Is there a particular title that you're hearing a lot of demand for just now before the dandelions are up?
Well, gosh, it's hard just to pick a couple. We have, our clientele is so huge and so varied, and their reading interests are so varied That it's hard just to select a few. Now, the bestseller list, of course, the New York Times or the Publishers Weekly weekly bestseller lists are always popular. And I did bring a Publishers Weekly with me here today if you wanted to see some of the things that are on that list right now. Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn has been wildly popular for quite some time. And I think it's because even though it's, well, not to say even though, but it is a female author. But because she's written such a thriller, a psychological suspense thriller, that I think we're getting readership of both women and men for that one. And it's been on the bestseller list forever, it seems like. I've read it myself. I really enjoyed it. And I think a lot of people are interested in picking that one up.
And I'm looking at a blurb here from the Chicago Tribune. Keeps you reading with a force of a pure but nasty addiction. I guess that's, I guess that could be a good time.
Well, I don't know if I love psychological suspense books. Love them. I don't know. I can't put them down. This one I thought was really good. I don't know. I didn't see anything nasty about it. It was kind of scary and it kept you thinking, what's going to happen next? But it wasn't as, gruesome as some things that you might read.
When you see certain books take off, do they tend to bring in, imitators? I mean, a genre might be a category which started with just one book once upon a time. But, for instance, when The Da Vinci Code took off a few years ago, did the library see a lot of interest in general in books about arcane mysteries and conspiracies reaching back through the misty shadows of time and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anytime you get a wildly popular book like that, you get a lot of imitators. And I can't think of the author's name. There is an author now that writes very similar to Dan Brown that's also all about conspiracies. It's about ancient ruins. It's about how that impacts what's going on in the world today. And it's something about the Templar.
The Knights Templar, but
yeah.
There's only one other writer writing about the Knights
Templar.
Oh,
no,
someone's become very effective doing it.
Exactly, exactly. Another example is the popular 50 Shades of Grey, which really opened up a whole new genre as far as erotic fiction. So we're getting a lot of copycats on that one as well.
And that's strange to talk about being old enough to remember when a book like 50 Shades of Grey would not have been in the public library.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, we are a popular materials library, and we like to bring things to our wide variety of people and what they read. And that's certainly been on the bestseller list and has been very popular.
Okay. And there are other titles also meeting that interest now that are coming up.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Looking more at your list for today. Now I have to find it, but I think you have it in front of you. If you can recommend another title.
Certainly. Let's see here. We've done a couple on the women's side. Maybe we'll switch over to the men's side. There's a new author that's coming out that's getting a lot of attention. They're calling him a modern-day John Steinbeck or Ernest Hemingway.
Really?
Yeah. His name is Philip Meyer, and Philip has one L and two P's. And his latest one is called The Sun. And it jumps between three generations of a family in Texas. And it starts at the wild frontier and it goes through to the Civil War and then right up to the present day.
And here we're talking, this sounds a little weightier than, say, than Stephen King or Dan Brown, if he's being compared to Hemingway. And here he is. I'm finding him on Amazon right now. What other titles is he known for?
Let's see. He wrote one that had a lot of critical acclaim called American Rust. I find his writing to be similar to John Steinbeck, kind of a Grapes of Wrath thing going, where we're talking about Americana, the struggles in the American countryside. Although this latest one, The Sun, does have more of a historical element of watching a family through three generations.
From the Comanche raids of the 1800s to the oil booms of the 20th century, says the blurb here. But and that's interesting that in the list you've put together with some lighter fare, And there is a way also, there is a way to escape when you're dealing with several generations of a family. This is going to take you just far away from your life in the suburbs, perhaps.
Certainly. And I think this is probably another situation, like you mentioned earlier, where you're reading this and maybe you want to know more about that geographical region or that time in American history.
Well, Elizabeth Strom, Kelly Strom?
Yes.
I will have to look up Elizabeth Strom. My note's a little off here, but from the Champaign Public Library, thank you very much for sharing some reading choices today on Focus, which I'm sure you can find at your public library wherever you are. And our thanks to NPR's Guy Raz for joining us earlier to talk about the 3-Minute Fiction Contest. You can find out more online just by Googling NPR 3-Minute Fiction. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Remember, we're live each weekday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580 with a replay at 8 p.m. Go to our website, will.illinois.edu, to hear the show streamed online, or where you can listen to years of past programs. And Focus is available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, visit will.illinois.edu/focus. Tomorrow on Focus, Bond, James Bond. It's 60 years since Ian Fleming created him, and his fan base has only grown larger. Tomorrow on Focus, we'll talk about Bond, his legacy, and the Bond-related materials being donated to the University of Illinois with a couple of James Bond experts. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon, and Jason Croft is our technical director. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows.